Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. You are listening to the Saturday Science Club on Soho Radio with me, Matilda Hay, and it is a beautiful day. We have got such an exciting show coming up for you. I feel like I need 3 hours, not just 1 hour, because I am joined today by my good friend and science journalist, Amna Morgate, who works for IFLS, or as some of us know its real name, I effing love science. I'm trying to still keep it PC there for you. So along with talking to her about science of Game of Thrones, we're also going to be raising water with the click of our fingers. And getting more of an insight into life as a science journalist. So all of that coming up for you. But first, as always, to get your brain moving, here is my weekly riddle. So a bit more of a kind of logic-y problem-solving one. Got to think outside the box. You've got a cake. I don't know why, but you've got a cake and you want to cut it into 8 pieces. And because you're super competitive, you want to cut it into 8 pieces using only 3 cuts of your knife. How do you do it? You can tweet us at Soho Radio if you think you know the answer, and we will be revealing it at the end of the show. Amna, have you got any ideas?
Oh, God, no. I'm really, really bad with riddles.
Well, you've got
I have a good thing.
An hour to have a thing, yeah. And you've chosen all our songs today. So what song do you want to kick off with?
I'm really, really excited that Missy Elliott is like performing again. So I know she was at Glastonbury and now she's going to be at festival. So let's do an old school song of hers, which is Get Your Freak On.
People you don't know, me and Timberland been high since 20 years ago. What the dealio, now what the drillio. If you wanna battle me, then people, let me know. Got the feeling, son, let me throw you some. People, here I come. Now sweat me when I'm done. We got the radio shook like we got a gun.
Back the beat. Thank you so much, Missy Elliott. Absolutely love that song. Oh, it's got me in such a good mood. But now it is, of course, time for science news. And the big story this week was New Horizons, a spaceship, flew by Pluto. And we got the best photos of Pluto ever. And one thing that I really liked is Russell Watson recorded a song ages ago, which apparently he uses to play to astronauts when they're like waking up in the space station. But it was because it's such a long way to travel to Pluto. Once the spaceship was on its trajectory, it kind of shuts down and basically hibernates. Mm. And so when they like kickstarted all the engines again and woke it back up, they played this recording. So I'm just going to give you a little taster of this right now.
This is Russell Watson. It's been a long road.
Before we go into the more exciting,
nearly 3 billion miles, I can hardly believe it myself, and 9 years since the launch. And your time is finally here. I've played this song to wake astronauts in orbit around the Earth, but never for a NASA spacecraft waking on its voyage to the farthest reaches of the solar system. It will be cold and dark at Pluto. But you won't be alone. You carry the dreams of explorers everywhere. I have faith that you'll inspire us with views of a new world like we've never seen before, while blazing the path for NASA and their missions to follow you through the solar system and beyond. New Horizons, your adventure of Pluto awaits. Safe travels. God bless.
It's been a long road, and getting from there to here, it's been a long time, but my time is finally here. I can feel the change in the wind right now, nothing's in my way, and I'm not gonna hold it down no more, no, I'm not gonna hold it down, cause I've got I'm going on a hard road.
I feel suitably epic right now.
That's beautiful.
Brilliant. You just imagine looking out at the stars, listening to that. It'd be so great. So yeah, Pluto, New Horizons flew past Pluto, and we got the best pictures we've ever had of the surface of the planet. And what everyone seems to be excited about is there's this area that they've named Sputnik Plain, after the first artificial satellite around Earth. Yes. And it's got, it's very flat and kind of icy. And then it's got these sort of, it's sort of broken up into these almost polygons that are 20 to 30 kilometres across. And then they've got sort of troughs of dark material in between them. And they're just sort of lots of hypotheses about what has caused them. So some scientists think they might have been caused by like the surface of the planet kind of bulging due to gentle heating coming from the core. And this can happen when the gravitational field as Pluto moves around in orbit, sort of pulling on the planet, slightly changing its shape. But then others say maybe it's a bit like when we get cracks in the mud, and it's to do with some sort of evaporation process and a loss of some sort of liquid from that surface that's left it all kind of cracked. So lots of speculations, only the beginning of looking at these images. But yeah, everyone is super excited. But what I kind of liked even more was they've gone on a massive naming spree. So they've got all these pictures. And there's an actual quote somewhere of someone saying, well, we just get bored of saying, you know, dark spot on the right and mountain to the north. So they've started giving them all names, because Pluto is obviously named after the Roman god of the underworld, which apparently, so when it was discovered in 1930, they had a competition to name the planet. And so it was actually named by an 11-year-old girl called Venetia Burney from Oxford. And she chose the name Pluto because it was dark and far away, like the Roman god of the underworld. And she received £5 as a reward for her name.
That's brilliant. I didn't realise that.
I know, isn't it so cool? So they're sticking with this theme of like god of the underworld. And they've named different features like Mengpo, which is the Buddhist goddess of forgetfulness and amnesia. They've got Balrog, the demon from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And the one that most people are really excited about is an area in the South Pole, which was ages ago they used to call it the Whale. But they've now named it, I'm not even sure I could pronounce this correctly, Chultu, who's one of the great old ones from the stories by H.P. Lovecraft. And he sort of lurks under the sea in this sunken city, and he's got tentacles all over his face. And yeah, he's pretty badass. So yeah, not only have we got brand new images of the surface of Pluto, we've got some very exciting names for them.
I mean, what's really cool about New Horizons, they've got like 9 different artifacts on the spaceship.
Yes.
And one of them is actually, I think, an ounce of the remains of the researcher who discovered Pluto.
Yeah, absolutely. And he died 9 years before the launch, but it was his greatest wish to have his ashes scattered in space. And they've got them there in a little plaque.
I thought that was really cute. Just like he, you know, gone kind of returning home.
I think that's just amazing. It's so nice. So your favourite science news stories, what have you come across this week, Amna?
So the tube strikes happened, and everyone was really complaining about their commute and about how terrible it is. I just wanted to remind everyone how lucky we are when it comes to evolution, because I found this hilarious story of nematode worms who have a rather unconventional commute. It turns out these are like the most intensely studied biological models, but we really don't know anything about their ecology, which is a bit of a problem, because we can't really see how, you know, their behaviors or the physical characteristics actually are in their natural context, because they've just been grown in labs for the last 50 years or so. And researchers from Germany went out to see how these nematode worms live, and they found out that they get inside slugs' guts, stay there for a bit, and they survive this really less than friendly internal environment, aren't digested or anything, and then just get pooped out at their destination.
So do they decide like which bit of poo they want to hop on, or is it just like potluck as to when you get dislodged?
So that's something I asked the researcher, and he's like, we're not too sure, we think they might, but that's something he's going to go on to research, you know, who presses the bell when just, it's at their stop.
Imagine the slug sending some sort of hormone which is like, we have reached the cabbage, and the nematode worm's like, awesome, I'm getting off at the stop.
And they've just used these slugs to just get across gardens, and it's absolutely amazing.
This definitely has put the tube into perspective. Yes, it's an underground tunnel, but at least it's not trying to digest us and poop us out.
Exactly. So that's just another story of nature being absolutely hilarious and weird. Another really cool story that I came across was that scientists have found the world's oldest fossilized sperm.
Yes, I saw this. I thought it was really cool as well.
It's amazing. It's 50 million years old and it was found in Antarctica. And like all great science, you know, discoveries, they found it by accident, just stumbled upon it.
The best way.
So the researchers are saying, you know, they just kind of were looking at these... these cocoons for something else entirely, and then they realized there were some fossils inside of it. They went out, got it analyzed and looked at, and realized that actually this is probably one of the oldest sperms that we've come across. It's 10 million years older than the next animal sperm that we've seen. And interestingly enough, you know, the cocoon that it was in, that the way it preserved it, we think that we might be able to find other fossils in a very similar way because it preserves it the way amber does.
So if we now just go and look at all the cocoons.
And the researchers made a really interesting point saying we need to stop just looking at kind of hard exterior details like paleontologists do, so bones and stuff, and like try to look at these much more soft organic materials.
So the cocoons preserved the organics material.
In the fossil that we did find, there wasn't any organic DNA material, so we're not going to have any Jurassic style extraction process occurring. Yeah, unfortunately, they were very clear to dash all of that, those hopes, which is quite funny. But they were just saying it's interesting the way that fossilization occurs, and we think it happens the way amber traps plant materials and animals.
And you could really speculate about the sex life of those worms. Like the cocoon, their loving nest.
Yeah,
lady, I'm going to take you to my cocoon.
I think they think it's a hermaphrodite, so just him doing, you know, he or she doing its own thing in the cocoon.
Oh wow.
Like releasing both releasing both egg and sperm cells into the cocoon, and it's so it's supposed to protect the reproduction process that occurs, but it just ended up being fossilized, which is good fun, I think.
That is really fun. The only other bit of science news that I thought was quite interesting and a little bit relevant to the fact that it's now summer. Well, last weekend I was up in Scotland and I got eaten alive by midges. And there's been an experiment done recently looking at how do mosquitoes actually kind of work out where their prey is and like who to like zone in on how to feed, where the blood is. And it turns out it's actually the smell or their kind of sense of carbon dioxide gas.
Oh, wow.
Which then triggers them to home in on visual cues. So it's not like they're flying along and they see something and they're like, oh yeah, cool, that thing might have blood. It's actually any time they're aware of carbon dioxide, especially if it's mixed with kind of warmth and moisture, because all animals breathe out carbon dioxide, they will then suddenly pay much more attention to their visual cues and hone in on whatever stands out from the environment. So the way they tested this was they had a bunch of mosquitoes in a wind tunnel, just chilling in their wind tunnel flying along, and there was a big black dot on the ground. And whenever they blasted carbon dioxide into the wind tunnel, the mosquitoes would suddenly notice that black dot and fly down to it and try to bite it.
Wow.
Yeah, so... I don't know, maybe we need to work on like wearing masks.
They also,
disguise our CO2, a new kind of mosquito repellent.
Yeah.
stealth operation. We've got one more very exciting bit of science news, more of a discussion coming up. But first, let's have another song. So what do you want next, Emma?
So Chris, my husband, has like made a little shout out. He'd love to have a Cat Stevens song, so we'll just go with that. Can't keep it in.
This one's for you, Cat. Not Cat, Chris.
Oh, I can't keep it in. I can't keep it in. I've got to let it out. Oh, oh, oh. I've got to show the world. World's got to know. Know of the love. Love that lies low. So why can't you say? If you know, then why can't you say? You got too much. It's deceit. Deceit kills the light.
Brilliant. If you have just joined us, coming up, we have got Science of Game of Thrones, as well as a cool experiment where we can raise water with our hands. So stay tuned. But right now, I've got with me Amna Morgate, science journalist, and there's been a really interesting discussion in science news just this week that just prompted me to think that in your role as a science journalist, how do you navigate these more kind of ethical discussions? And in your writing, like, do you try and keep balance? Do you have to put an opinion in? I mean, I suppose we should backtrack and talk about what the actual discussion is. But yeah, like,
so lately, there's been a lot of discussion of homeopathy. And yeah, I think as a science journalist, I definitely, where I'm at right now, just as a reporter, wouldn't put any of my own opinions in, because I want to report the news and what other far more interesting people are saying. So Jeremy Corbyn, who's running to be, he's one of the Labour members running to be leader, and someone found like a tweet that he did in 2010 where he justifies kind of, I think, being in favour of having an NHS provision for homeopathic treatments. And I'm not really sure if he still feels the same way.
Yeah.
But the internet lives on, and if you said something 5 years ago, people are going to like massively hone in on it. So there's been a lot of discussion on that. I mean, the British Medical Journal had two different editorials, one in favour of us using homeopathic medicine in the NHS and one completely against it. And this is such a divisive kind of issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So for anyone that doesn't know, what is homeopathic medicine?
So it's quite interesting. It's the idea of you take the medicine and dilute it to such an extent that
it's like one drop in 500 drops of water,
it's, you know, it's really not there anymore. And the whole idea is you take it thinking you're taking the medicine and you feel better. You actually not only feel better, you actually get better. It's, you know, this interesting phenomenon called the placebo effect. And in most scientific experiments, you test a new drug against a placebo where it's a control group and people are just getting sugar pills, they're not actually getting the drug. And then researchers were quite surprised to find some people in this control group were actually getting better.
No,
so
the placebo effect is absolutely fascinating.
I mean, I don't think we really know that much about it, but
it's like power of mind and body. It's
if you just, you're willing yourself, you think, yeah, this is working, you know, this drug is great.
And that's the crucial thing, you have to believe that it's going to work. So I suppose, although there's not really any scientific evidence proving that homeopathic treatment works, if you're someone who believes that it does, maybe it will for you.
Exactly. So that was a really interesting, the two editorials in the BMJ where someone was saying, you know, homeopathy is relatively safe. I mean, as long as you don't encourage to use it for far more lethal diseases like cancer. I mean, I think people were quite critical when a group tried to use homeopathy during the Ebola epidemic last year, and they weren't allowed, and they were, you know, crying about being discriminated against. But like, not for things like that. And I think like for a flu, or people would go turn to homeopathy. And the editorial saying it's cheaper, it improves clinical outcomes without increasing cost, and that's a big discussion now about costs in the NHS.
True.
But the argument against, you know, was really quite interesting. We don't really want to turn to these medicine because it's cheaper, because also we don't really know down the line what's going to happen if, you know, doctors start prescribing placebo effects to people and then they die because they haven't actually had
real medicine.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Some Ian Dunt wrote an interesting column in politics.co.uk where he said the homeopathy is a, you know, a moral test. And I
what
looked
does
in
he mean by that?
So he's just kind of saying there are objective truths in the world that we live in, and objectively the, you know, homeopathy is not, like, shouldn't be treated as a medical treatment. It doesn't work.
Yeah, it's this one drop
and
of some.
Just because you personally believe it does, that doesn't really matter, because science has already had,
we've got science, we've got proof.
Exactly. So that's what he's kind of talking about, and it's interesting. You know, should we give space for people who have all ridiculous notions of things that we know just aren't true and stuff? But there was a kind of good counterpoint made by Greg Dash on The Guardian. He's saying this just isn't the way to engage with people who do believe in homeopathy, or let's say, for example, who are completely against vaccines. Telling them they're, you know, morally wrong or they're stupid, it doesn't change their point of view. I mean, research has shown if you go up to someone, if I personally really believe, let's say, red is the best colour, and this just looking at red is going to make me feel amazing, and you come up to me and you just say, and I'm just going to look at it, and you say, this is nonsense, this is not based on anything, and this is a real personal belief I have, I'm not going to just change it because you've told me that, or, you know, if we've had some sort of social media discussion about it. But if you engage with me in some way, we have discussion and I'm not treated like an idiot. I'm
so it's like, kind of like, why is red your favourite colour?
Exactly.
What are these associations?
So that's
you know,
Dash is arguing on The Guardian. We need to look at the behaviour of people. Why are people turning to homeopathy than kind of effective drugs that have been shown to work? And it's really interesting. We were talking about this earlier. You know, it takes you ages to get an appointment with the doctor. And when you do, you've got like 5-10 minutes
yeah,
and that's it.
Well,
clearly, apparently that just doesn't happen in homeopathy kind of clinics. It's this kind of, the patient has a certain amount of power to discuss how they feel about their own body, which sometimes people say you don't get in modern medicine. So a really good example of this is, you know, contraceptive for women. You can go to a doctor and say, this is making me feel crazy, I hate being on this contraception, and sometimes they're just like, oh, just stay with it, maybe it'll pass. And if you're a woman going into that situation, you leave, you feel kind of powerless about, you know, your own body. I mean, no one's going to force you to stay on something you don't want, but
you feel like there's no
if you're
option.
Really, you know, if you feel like, oh, I am actually having really bad mood swings, or I am feeling depressed because I'm taking this contraceptive, and then someone doesn't seem to echo that view that you have, it can be really disempowering. And I think, you know, Dash is making a really good point where if patients aren't being engaged with, and I mean, people just don't have time now. I mean, I'm not blaming doctors or GPs now at all. Yeah. They've got so many people they have to see, but just that kind of personal element just seems to be there in homeopathy. And I didn't realise that at all. So
I've never thought of it like that. I've always dismissed it. I've always just been like, no science behind it, no evidence.
I think rubbish. Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't believe it in myself. I mean, when I'm ill, I'm just like, give me the drug that works.
Yeah.
Make me feel better.
I like to understand the chemical reactions going on in my body.
But
and then
I think
them.
Like, I'm kind of, starting to think, okay, why do you think this way? Kind of talk to me, explain it to me. I mean, just to discuss it. I mean, it's all of our NHS, so we should have a full and open discussion about the type of medicine we want. I'm definitely going to be on the no of the homeopathy side of it, but I just don't want it. I don't really know the idea of having a moral discussion about it is really the right way, or saying someone is stupid, or, you know, not.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right way to have this discussion.
No, that's a really good point. You need to just talk about it without bringing in your own personal biases to those people for believing that.
Yeah, definitely.
Fascinating. Oh, the minefield of trying to communicate science, especially when it's kind of like touch and go, and these are big decisions to make.
Definitely.
And someone running for leader, like, their beliefs are going to impact on how they run things. Wow. Okay, well, back to the music.
Yes.
What do you want next?
I chose this one because I think it's a song we bonded over when we first met. Yes, let's put on No Scrubs by TLC.
I absolutely love this. No, I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Hanging on the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me. I don't want no scrub. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Hanging on the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me. Well, the scrub's checking me, but his game is kind of weak, and I know that. Any scrubs in here?
No, we don't.
Not at all. Now, I did say today that we were going to be raising water with the wave of our hand. What I didn't tell you was we were also going to have some props to help us do this. There will be hand waving. Hand waving's kind of optional. It will work with or without, as long as you have the props. So what you need is like a shallow kind of plate or bowl, a little bit of blue tack, a candle. I'm using a birthday candle right here, some matches and some water. Obviously, got to raise it up. So the first thing I want you to do is take your blue tack and use it to stick the candle upright onto your plate. So it should be in the middle of the plate, nice and upright. Then the next step is you're going to light the candle. Oh, if you there we go, nice match lighting there. So you've got a candle burning in the middle of your plate. Now, gently add water to the plate, so until it's sort of just covering the base. And so it's almost like the candle is burning in the middle of a little lake or a little puddle. And then the final thing I think I forgot to mention is that you need a glass or some sort of tube, any kind of cylindrical object with a hole at one end and close at the other. And what you're going to do is you're going to put your glass on top. So the candle is inside it and it comes down onto the plate. And as the candle burns, what you should see, and this is where the hand waving comes in, is the water is rising up from the bottom of the plate into the glass. And eventually the candle will go out. But most of that water has now been sucked up into the glass. Are you impressed, Amna?
I am very impressed. That is so cool.
Do you have any ideas how it's working?
No. How is it working?
Okay, so what's going on here is, obviously, as we learn about our fire triangle in about year 8 at school, for anything to burn, you need your fuel, you need heat, and you need oxygen. And when we put the cup over the candle, there's only a certain amount of oxygen in that air, and 20% to be precise. And so once all the oxygen has been burnt up by the candle and there's none left, it will go out. But because it's been burning up that oxygen and removing it from the air and from the sort of gas inside the glass, there is a lower pressure within the glass and it sucks the water in. This lower pressure sucks the water up and holds it there.
Wow. Yeah. That is so cool.
So
definitely that's something to try at home.
How to make water rise. A really good one for impressing, like magic trick style, impressing friends or kids. But now onwards to what I've probably been most excited about all day, all week. We are combining two of both mine and Amna's favourite things.
Yes.
Combining science with Game of Thrones. Okay, being a bit indulgent with the theme tune there. So
I wonder how many days of our lives we've literally wasted just watching the opening credits of Game of Thrones.
Oh my god, but it's just so good.
It's so long.
I don't mind. I'll waste those time and minutes every time. Now, you wrote this piece for IFLS a while ago, actually. And yeah, you called it Science of Game of Thrones, looking at the science behind some of the deaths.
Yes.
And it was absolutely fascinating. So I'm just going to let you take it away. Tell us about them.
So it was a really interesting commissioned show that Helen Keane and Ian Simmons did together, and they were just looking at the science of Game of Thrones, you know, why is the weather like it is in Game of Thrones. And then I started to have a bit of a think, and I was like, what is the one main thing that we see throughout Game of Thrones? And that's that they kill all of our favorite characters.
Death.
I mean, when they say, you know, all men must die, they're really not messing about. And that last season was just absolutely
heartbreaking.
So I'll try to not do any season 5 spoilers, but if you haven't watched it, why? So, you know, in season 1, Viserys Targaryen, for those who don't remember, is the horrible brother of Daenerys, who essentially sold her off in hopes of him getting the Iron Throne.
Threatens her
in the scene where he's literally threatening to cut open her stomach while she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And ironically, he doesn't get crowned. He doesn't get crowned king. Instead, he gets crowned with molten gold. So I spoke to Ian. I said, you know, how likely is this to happen? Because, you know, they're in a tent and gold is being melted.
That's got to get pretty hot, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so it's unlikely the scene would have happened in the way it did.
Probably be outside the tent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, gold has a melting point of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So it would have been really warm in that tent. But, I mean, speaking to Ian, he said if it was a mixed alloy of gold,
then so maybe it would have had like
a
lower...
Yeah, maybe it would have had a lower temperature.
Oh,
and maybe
surely
you would have... died
Khaleesi,
in a way
it would need to be pure.
Yeah, you know. I mean, he looked into the history of if anyone's died this way, and they haven't, but plenty of people were executed by having molten gold poured down their throat. Yeah,
that
so the most
execution method.
Yeah, so the most famous being Roman Emperor Valerian the Elder, who was captured by the Persian king Shapur the First. I'm pronouncing these horribly wrong, but Shapur used him as a living footstool for some years, and then he executed him by pouring molten gold down his throat.
Oh my God.
So researchers being researchers thought, how do you die if you get molten gold poured down your throat? What exactly
burns.
Kills you? So they looked into this in the 2003 study in the Journal of Clinical Pathology, where they poured molten gold down a dead cow's larynx in a slaughterhouse, and they saw that the gold produced a blast of steam and it ruptured the internal organs.
Oh wow.
And I've got a quote from Simmons saying, so if the steam or shock of pain didn't kill you instantly, you suffocate from having actually a blocked throat.
Okay, because the gold would kind of solidify in your throat. And I guess the steam, is that coming because you've got so much water in your cells?
Exactly.
And it's suddenly being turned into a gas by the heat and breaking out. Oh my God.
It's like pretty dire way of dying when it comes to God. It, really. Another interesting thing I looked into was wildfire. It's just like, what on earth is wildfire?
So
in, you know, we know in Game of Thrones that wildfire is created by the Alchemist Guild. They don't really magical. Go into it more than that, but we know that it continues to burn even if you're in water.
So there, like napalm in the Vietnamese war, that burnt on wet forests.
Yeah, so that's what exactly. So that's the very similar thing that exists is napalm. So good. Yeah, so they apparently used it quite a lot during the Byzantine civil wars, and it was called Greek fire then.
Oh, so they did have it.
Yeah, and they just threw it at each other during these wars. And the closest thing we think about it is now is napalm. So
is napalm green?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. But
so a slight tweak there.
Yeah,
but definitely possible.
I mean, it's quite interesting. You think it's a fantasy show, but I think particularly with science fiction, they try to base it in some reality.
Yeah.
Something that everyone discussed was, can you crush a skull with your hands?
Oh, the famous killing, the mountain versus Oberon.
I mean, this was like, loads of science journalists were just, this was the question of the time, the big science question. So, you know, we had the Washington Post saying, no, you cannot crush a human skull with your bare hands. And then the New York Times did an editorial saying, yes, you can. And
are they going out and trying it themselves? Just,
yeah, I mean, like, this, you know, really, it's quite funny. And I spoke to Simmons and he definitely sits in the no camp. And I think I might as well. So the reasoning kind of behind this is that it would be impossible, he says, even for the strongest human to break the skull the way it does it in the show, because his eyes kind of burst inwards. So the pressure would have to be from inside his skull.
Okay.
Because his eyes kind of just burst out.
Yeah. So
that wouldn't happen ever.
If you're breaking it by pushing in on it.
So, you just have to. I mean, the worst that would probably happen is, you know, it gets a bit shallow, but that's really it. But it's like, can someone have the power to actually crush a human skull? And Simmons does this in the show that he does, where he asks someone to press onto a piece of rock and it shows how much power he's actually pressing onto it. And the giant weighs over 1,000 pounds. Okay. So, you know, and that's a lot of that is pure muscle. So should he be able to do it? And Simmons says, no, he wouldn't be even able to do it if he was standing on top of Oberyn's head trying
really?
To crush himself. So we've got pretty strong skulls.
That's actually quite
encouraging. I think that's a good thing out of that, you know. Probably won't die from in that way, but yeah.
We are safe. We're safe from having our skulls crushed.
I mean, and I asked, you know, as a science journalist, I asked the important science questions, and the next ones were, you know, are White Walkers a thing? No. I mean, I was relieved to hear that. No zombies and can you know, can a woman dressed in red make a shadow baby to kill me?
God.
And apparently no, so you know, doing my duty there.
Well, I got quite excited because, I mean, obviously everyone would love to believe that dragons might be real.
Yes.
And they're based on something. So you said they're actually, there's something called a wyvern?
Yeah, so in like, this is me being a total dork, in like fantasy, usually the six-limbed vertebrates are the dragons, but in Viserys dragons, they're only four-limbed.
I did not know that dragons meant to have six limbs. So they have like four legs.
Yeah, so they've got two legs and their wings are their arm.
Oh.
So that was interesting.
Oh, yeah, and these guys, their wings are kind of their arms as well.
Yeah, so.
Got it.
And I was just like, this is like, yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, in the Game of Thrones universe, they explain that is what a dragon is, but technically not. I mean, yeah, Ian kind of says it's in their favour because obviously there are no six-limb vertebrates.
Yeah.
So if there was ever going to be a dragon, it would be something with four limbs. But, you know, Mother of Wyverns doesn't have the same gravitas. Tone as Mother of Dragons.
Well,
so.
Actually, in the news this week was that they found a fossil of an ancestor of the Velociraptor, or a relation of the Velociraptor, that's kind of half Velociraptor, on the cusp of becoming a bird. And, I mean, I'm sure it's just for the headlines, but they've described it as a winged dragon.
Yes, I saw.
So, in some ways, you could say, you know, back in the day, this was found like in China. Mm. So in the East, where, you know, dragons are, you know, meant to be. And it was 6 foot 6 inches. That's about 2 meters, perfectly preserved in some limestone. And they said it was unlikely to have been able to fly. But that, yeah, and it wouldn't have had scales, but it had feathers, and it's, you know, linked to a dinosaur. So maybe you could see how you might have a sword dragon in prehistoric times. Oh, it's just wishful thinking.
I mean, the really interesting thing is why haven't like any of us, any animal, really evolved to breathe fire?
That is a fantastic question.
And apparently, it just doesn't seem to be very useful. Ian says, well, I can find a use for breathing fire.
Yeah.
But no, there isn't. But there's a really interesting beetle that's able to squirt out a hot mix of hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, which is the closest thing we have to something breathing out fire.
I'm going to get me some of these beetles. Yeah. Mother of the fire beetles. Yeah. Here I come. Okay, what song are we having next? Thank you, Amna. That was absolutely fascinating. That was, yeah, I'm loving it.
Yeah, let's have Montel Jordan. This is how we do it. Get me up, because it's Saturday.
True that. You gotta get your groove on before you go get paid. So tip up your cup and throw your hands up and let me hit the party say, I'm kind of buzzed and it's all because this is how we do it. South Central does it like nobody does. This is how we do it. To all my neighbors, you got much flavor. Yes, on to you, Amna, and what it is like being a science journalist. When did you know you wanted to be a science journalist?
So I studied biology, and I, at the time, really wanted to be a scientist, but I was just an absolute disaster in the lab. Like, oh, God, every little thing that could go wrong would go wrong with me. So I was just like, oh, God, what do I do? And I was involved in student media at the time, and I kind of stumbled across the master's course that kind of all science journalists really end up doing. So I thought, yeah, I'll give it a go. And I realised, yeah, I really love talking about science. That's my favourite thing. And
yeah, so fascinating. The opportunity. I get so excited about it.
I know, and just like telling other people, like, you know, whether it's hilarious stories of nematode worms or, you know, trying to get science in like one of the most popular TV shows around. I just such a varied kind of role that I get to do.
Yeah.
And I think the thing I love most about it is just I get to look at everything. I don't, you know, when someone becomes a researcher, they tend to focus on a teeny tiny bit of cell and like that for the next
super specialized. Yeah,
and I think just being able to have that diverse breadth of knowledge is something that I love being able to.
How do you go about finding the stories that you're going to cover?
So there's, I guess, like some of it is just like, again, just watch Game of Thrones and just questions coming that up come up it, in yeah. my head. Like I watched that, you know, the scene where the mountain kind of crushes Oberyn's head, and I was like, can he actually do that?
good skeptical mind.
Yeah, and I think
right there.
Yeah, just a skeptical kind of mind, and it'd be really, yeah, it's just really funny things. I'll watch things and wonder why does that happen, or, you know, I'll go out for a drink and I'm just like, why do I need to go to the toilet loads when I'm drinking alcohol, or why do I hiccup? And I think these kind of questions loads of people have, and that's mostly
like
where I get
the hallmark of a scientist, isn't it?
Yeah,
curiosity and just letting that power you through and following it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also just like subscribe to a few of the funnier journals, just because ecology is hilarious. So, you know, I just kind of once, it wasn't even press released or anything, no one really covered it, but I just came across a journal that was, yeah, these Darwin Buck spiders. As you know, male spiders usually get eaten after having sex, and as a way of, you know, trying to survive, they were giving the females oral sex, and it was just this little one line, you know, in the abstract being like, there were liquid droplets in the genitals of the female fox spider. And I'm like, what does this mean? So I called up the researcher and they were like, yeah, we think it's oral sex.
Wow, spiders having oral sex. The things you learn on a daily basis. That's amazing.
So I think, yeah, and it's really interesting, like, obviously biomedical breakthroughs that we see now, and things like, you know, we are like having these amazing images of Pluto. I just kind of get really excited by it.
Yeah, it's so great, get to spend all day looking at it.
Yeah.
So So you work for IFLS, or better known as I Effing Love Science.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because that started as a Facebook group.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm someone who likes that page and loves all that feed. And what have they grown into now, and what's it like working for them?
So yeah, so it started by Elise Andrews, and she kind of started her in like second year in Sheffield, and it became so big so quickly. I think within the first few weeks she's getting thousands of likes, and she was just sharing these memes and images. And then what kept happening was loads of people kept emailing me like, why does this happen, or have you seen the science news? And she thought, okay, gonna create a website, which she launched last year. And she, you know, we've just now launched an editorial team in, you know, just around the corner from here in Holborn.
Wow.
So there's about, I think, five of us or six of us who just report on different science stories. And I love our morning meetings because it's just different things people have come across or they think is really interesting. And I'm just like, that's, you know, that's really scary that, you know, this disease is getting, this outbreak is happening, or oh my god, I've never really thought about this animal reproduces in this way. So
what I really love about IFLS is you've got some really interesting like hardcore stuff, but you've also got such a sense of humor
mixed in. I think that's our, you know, we don't really have an editorial kind of massive guideline yet, but I think that's, you know, keep it in a humorous, fun way, and
keep it relevant.
Also just trying to be accessible to as many people as possible. And I just don't think there are many places like IFLS right now who can say, yeah, we get about 100 million people checking out our website a month, and people
big numbers.
Hold you.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's quite scary. I think I'm forced to really make sure I double check everything that I put out there now, because, you know, you can't really be lazy. People really hold you to it. You'll get like an email, be like, you used this pronoun in the wrong
they're just filling you up on your science, but
to be. And I think when you have like, that's the kind of terrifying thing, when you have such a large audience, you know, you really have to respect them and make sure the quality of things you're giving out there is to the best of the ability of your ability. So, you know, I am quite a new reporter. I've just been reporting for about a year now, but it's good pressure on me to make sure
definitely.
I get everything.
So what are you working on
ability.
At the moment that you're really excited
about? So now I'm just working on this feature on laughing gas.
Perfect. Fits,
you know,
in with festivals.
Exactly. And then oddly enough, I've never heard any young people refer to it as hippie crack, but the vast majority of the media does.
Hippie what? Crack?
Hippie crack.
Oh my god.
And like, have you ever heard of this?
No.
Exactly. So everyone,
get my walking stick out and wave it. I'll get your hippie crack out.
And I was speaking to Professor Nutt, and he was like, it's ridiculous because no, you know, self-respecting hippie will be seen with laughing gas. And it's absolutely nothing like crack, so we don't know why it's called that. But, you know, the government are passing a new drug legislation, and essentially anything that alters your mental state will be illegal unless it's been specifically exempted for. So, you know, caffeine or alcohol.
Ah.
But that's there, and this is a way of trying to combat the problem of legal highs. So, you know, you've got 15, 16-year-olds who want to try cocaine, can't really get any access to it, so they'll just go to a head shop or something that, you know, sells a legal version of that, you know, a copycat drug. We have no idea. I mean, I know it sounds a bit weird, but probably just buying the cocaine is far more safer than getting these copycat drugs, because
you just don't know what's in them.
And every time you go buy a new one, it'll be massively different to the one you've bought before. Whereas,
yeah, because when you're saying every time one legal high is banned, they literally just change a tiny molecule,
yeah, and
call
it's
something different.
Yeah. And so they've just been playing this cat and mouse game for the last decade or so. So the way they've dealt with it is having a blanket ban. So I kind of understand that, but, you know, I kind of understand where also Professor Nutt is kind of coming from.
Well,
where
he champions like alcohol is so dangerous.
Yeah.
And why
yeah.
do we give it all these special?
And he does a really, I mean, I you know, I think it's really interesting where he gives really, you know, this is how you can take this drug safely. These are things you should be worried for. If this happens, go see a doctor. So, you know, he does the whole crush, dab, wait for MDMA. And no one else is doing this. And it's like actually the vast majority of young people, you know, who do want to do drugs are going to do it. And if you're going to a party, if you're going to a festival and someone's doing MDMA, if they've been told how to do it safely, then, you know, that's far more likely for them to be safe than them having absolutely no clue what to do. You know, you can just see this young person is taking MDMA and they're like, it's not working for me, why? And then they just take loads more. And that's where the problem comes in. They get massively dehydrated, and if they're mixing it with certain things they shouldn't be. So he does these really safety campaigns where he's like, actually, you should crush your drug, you should wait, you know, an hour before taking any more. And having that kind of safe advice for someone, I think, is really important.
Yeah, definitely. And would actually probably save a lot of cases, a lot more from lives. The NHS.
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of interesting. I think loads of places are now reconsidering their drug laws. You know, marijuana is becoming, you know, medical marijuana is like half of the US states. It's legal there.
Yeah.
And a lot more places now are regulating marijuana use. And I think it's a new discussion that our generation needs to be start having, you know, is banning drugs in the way that
forward.
We do for is that
and also so you're are you saying laughing gas is included in this ban?
Yes,
is it,
it is
becoming illegal.
Yes, laughing gas is now illegal, and if you use it recreationally, if you I think it's illegal for you to sell laughing gas, and I don't think there's any possession.
You can
problem.
Still have it in the dentist though.
Yes
yeah, that's crazy because like yeah.
There's so many uses in laugh. There's so many things that use laughing gas, but yeah, can't use it to alter your mental state, whatever that means.
Yeah, caffeine, alcohol, super dangerous.
Yeah,
not that dangerous. Like,
it's
yeah.
really quite. I mean, like, even the person I spoke to who was supporting this bill was just like, "Well, we don't really know why they've added laughing gas to, you know, to this list." But then I said to him, "You know, blanket ban means blanket ban." So are we going to spend the next few years, you know, arguing for different things to be put in this exemption list? How big is this list going to start getting? You know, a bunch of researchers wrote a letter to the Times, and it included, you know, the Wellcome Trust, the Medical Research Council, who were just arguing this blanket ban on drugs is going to affect the research that we do on drugs, particularly, you know, clinical research on depression and other mental disorders.
Yeah, oh my God, that's so true. I never thought about effects.
It's very complicated, right? Because you are having, you know, you don't want these teenagers or anyone else who are getting copycat drugs to be put in harm's way. You don't want that to be as easily accessible for them. And if that goes underground, no one's going to go underground to look for copycat drugs. You're not going to go under. You're not going to go to your, you know, a dealer and say, "Could I have the copycat version of Coke?" You're just going to get Coke. So I kind of get that mentality, but I don't really know if banning is a thing we should be going, because this drug was this law was enacted in Ireland, and that's being used as an example by both sides of why it does work or it doesn't work of this debate. But Ireland now is looking into their drug laws, so they're looking into whether this blanket ban has actually worked, because there's some evidence to show actually the same or more amount of people are still dying from drugs.
God,
so
it's such a big topic.
Yeah,
don't know how you're going to be tackling that.
I know, it's terrifying, but that's what I'm really looking forward to. Yeah,
that's so interesting. I wish we could talk about it more, but we are actually running late and Tony Moore's show is up next, so stay tuned for that. Before we go, I just want to reveal very quickly the answer to the riddle was you cut it once down the middle, once again, so you've made four slices, and then your third slice is through this, like, the middle of the cake the other way, so like where the icing in the middle would be.
Yeah,
so you just turn it into two nice halves there. So it's one across the top, another one across the top, and then one sideways through the middle.
Yes.
That was the end. Amna, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
We
I really
are
enjoyed myself.
Finish with Can't Hold Us Down by Christina Aguilera.
Now it's time for me to come and give you more to say.